welcome back to our post afternoon session. Technological point. Lucien is going to use a flip chart. For optical reasons, maybe you would like to move further forward a bit. At least those of you who are sitting at the end.
If you can't read the subscript, then you're in trouble. Yeah.
Small announcement. We actually won't have, unfortunately, the talk from Dean this afternoon. So we might take it just slightly more leisurely before that. We'll try and keep to schedule until coffee, and then have directly a round table after the coffee break, and then the reception will start at 5:30 rather than 6:30. Okay, so there's not much need to introduce Lucien Hardy from Perota, and people behind this. This whole initiative, I'll just leave it to you. Yeah.
Thank you. So is this the right sort of level of volume? Okay. I'm very excited about this whole initiative. I think this collaboration between PI and Australia can really work out. I think in Australia there's a great group of people, and I can see it working better here than anywhere else, which is why PI was interested in doing this. So I think this will be good for foundations. I think quantum foundations is a really important subject. I think many of the problems of fundamental physics faces at the moment require the kind of foundational thinking that we in the field of quantum foundations have become more expert at in recent years. And so I think that it would be good to have that kind of involvement with fundamental physics, which is good news. But there is a sting in the tail. The sting in the tail is that that means that people working in quantum foundations have got to take what you might call the great project of theoretical physics seriously. It's not enough just to sort of sit behind the front line and sort of tidy up the mess that's left behind by other people. On the contrary, you have to be right there in the trenches, in some cases leading the way. So that's a hard thing to do, and that requires real work. And so I think the reason this kind of initiative is interesting is because I think fundamental physics does need quantum foundations, but that also means we need to get seriously involved in the problems of fundamental physics, and I think there's sometimes a tendency for people in the field to lag behind. So leaving behind PF and moving on to the present subject. So this is a talk about recent, that relates to recent stuff I've done aimed at finding a theory of quantum gravity. What I'm going to do is pick out a few conceptual issues that arise in this kind of project, and then show you in broad terms how quantum theory fits into this framework that I developed. So the framework is called the causaloid formalism, and the causaloid formalism is meant to be a candidate framework for a theory of quantum gravity. So one would hope you could get a theory of quantum, it would be a mathematical framework that's hospitable to a theory of quantum gravity. So far I've shown how you can put quantum theory into this framework. I'm working on how to put general relativity into the framework, and then hopefully one can also put quantum gravity into it. But I'm going to show you how quantum theory fits. But let me first of all talk about some of the kind of conceptual problems that we need to address. So in a theory of quantum gravity, we're going to expect something like indefinite causal structure. So let me explain what I mean by that and why I think that. In a standard quantum experiment, you may have a particle that can go through one of two slits. I don't have to draw that. And in that case, you might say there's no matter of fact as to whether the particle went through the left slit or the right slit. That's simply not something that there is a matter of fact about, at least so far as the bare quantum formula is concerned. I mean, maybe if you go beyond that into hidden variable theory, you may have an answer to that question. But in general, at the level of quantum theory, there is no matter of fact as to whether particle goes through path A or path B. And in general, in quantum theory, when you have some dynamical quantity which can vary, so whether it goes through path A or path B or anything else, then you expect there to be, in general, no matter of fact as to what the value of that quantity is in the absence of a measurement. In general relativity, one of the things you can measure is causal structure. So for example, you may have two points, which, for example, they may be marked out by some operational a crossing of some particles or something. And then you may want to know what's the interval between these two points. So what is delta S between these two points? You know, does it correspond to a space-like or to a time-like separation? And that is not something that's set out in advance, but rather it's something that you can calculate only after you've found the solution for the metric. Then you can calculate it. So this interval is something which can vary in the theory, just like the path taken can vary. Likewise, this can vary. And therefore, in the context of quantum theory, we expect it to be the case that if we don't make a measurement of the interval, then there will be no matter of fact as to the value of that interval. So there'll be no matter of fact as to whether this interval is space-like or time-like or to what its actual value is, which means we have indefinite causal structure. So I think indefinite causal structure raises very serious problems for how you might go about formulating a physical theory. We're very used in thinking about physical theories to having a lot of the machinery of causal structure fixed. So in particular, for example, we often think of evolving a state forward in time. Well, what does that even mean if we don't have definite causal structure? If we don't have a notion of what a time-like interval is, we can't talk about evolving a state forward in time. And there are many concepts, if you start to look at the way we think about physics, that rely on having a backdrop of definite causal structure. So one might ask how you can proceed in the absence of such causal structure. So I'll spend the first bit of this talk addressing those conceptual questions, and then I'll move on to how quantum theory fits into this framework. Okay. So, in a physical theory, what you want to do ultimately is to be able to say something about the way data gets correlated. So, let's just imagine here we have some big region of space-time. And since we may want to make the causal structure kind of fuzzy, we don't know which is space and which is time. It's all fuzzy and indefinite. But anyway, imagine we have some big region of space-time. We may collect some data. For example, you know, we may collect some data here and some data here. This may be data one, this may be data two. And we may want to be able to say something about how this data is correlated. So we may want to ask, we might want to be able to say something about the probability of data two given data one. Okay, well that's basically what we need a physical theory to do for us. And we may want it to do some extra things, like we might want it to provide a picture of reality. We may want it to provide an explanation as to why reality is the way it is. But at the very least, if a physical theory is a physical theory, then it must be able to do something like correlate data. So what we're talking about here is making a prediction pertaining to a particular region. In this case, it's a disjoint region that consists of two parts. But this is some region that we might call R. So what I want to do now is to define a property. Okay, I'm going to call it F locality. And this is a property that I want a physical, that I want the formulation of a physical theory to have, and I'll explain why I want that in a moment. Okay, F locality. So here's what F locality is. F locality is a property of a formulation of a physical theory, not necessarily of the sort of raw physical theory itself. And it's the property that you can make relevant assertions about probabilities pertaining to some region by considering only mathematical objects pertaining to that same region. Let me write that down. And by region here, I mean region of space-time. Okay, so slightly abbreviated it there. I'll read it again. F locality is the property, it's a property of a formulation of a theory that we can make relevant assertions about probabilities pertaining to some region by considering only mathematical objects pertaining to that region.
So we're not talking about general relativity.
This is just a property that formulations of physical theories may have in general. So it could be any theory, it could be general relativity that we're trying to formulate in this way, it could be quantum theory, it could be anything else.
What does the F mean?
Formulation, So the F stands for formulation. So the point is, you may have the same theory that can be formulated in different ways. So we know examples of that in the case of quantum theory. You can formulate quantum theory in a path integral formulation or the standard, Schrodinger evolving state formulation. So those are two different formulations of quantum theory. And those formulations may have different properties. This is the property of a kind of formulation. So it's not a property of the underlying physics necessarily, but rather the property of the formulation.
And when you talk about assertion about probabilities pertaining to a region, if it's conditional probability, then what appears on the left and the right of the conditional must pertain to that region?
So in this example, the total region I'm interested in is a region composed of these two bits. And that's my region. So my mathematical objects must pertain to the region R, which can borrow, which has data 1 and data 2.
Some philosophy, if you're saying that space time, you're taking that as being fuzzy defined here. Is the notion of a region defined?
So that's a good question. So what I'm not going to have the time to go into is how I understand regions. I have a kind of operational definition of regions. Really, a region is a sort of an area in data space from my point of view. And so that is well defined because you know what kinds of data you might collect. But I don't want to spend too much time on that point.
That's always said in general as well, that the space
time
is defined by properties.
Right, absolutely. I mean, which is why when I gave this example, I was thinking about, I gave the example of intersecting trajectories, and then the distance between them. Okay.
So your region is any parameter space, is that right?
When I get to quantum theory, if I get to quantum theory, I'll show you some examples of that. So maybe for the time being, we can leave that less precise. So I've defined this property, why is this the kind of thing we would want? Imagine it's not true. Imagine that in order to make predictions about some region, we need to consider mathematical objects pertaining to other regions. And imagine, furthermore, we have indefinite causal structure. Well, then how do we choose those other regions? So if we had definite causal structure, we could say, well, what we do is draw, for example, we could draw a box around it where this is a time-like surface, this is a space-like or something, and we could say, well, we need to evolve a state through here and do that. And that way we can sort of pick out enough information in our theory about these regions. But if we don't have definite causal structure, how do we select whatever region we choose in order to make predictions? And I'll illustrate that. Let's do that now. Let's think about three different types of ways that physical theories are usually formulated. So these are kind of the old pictures. So one picture is the idea of time evolution. So here you have a state that evolves from some initial time to some final time. And so if I wanted to make a prediction about these regions, well, I could evolve the state from some time 0 to some time t final. And as long as these two regions were inside that region covered, then you know I could pick out, using the machinery of the theory, the appropriate, you know, the appropriate predictions about this region and ignore all the rest. So that would work, but it does mean you have to refer to other regions apart from the region that you're interested in. And if you don't have definite causal structure, it's not clear what that region should be. What does it mean to have an initial surface and a final surface? Furthermore, it's wasteful. Why would you formulate physics in such a way that you had to refer to all this other stuff if you didn't have to? It's better, perhaps, to formulate it where you only need to refer to the stuff that you're interested in. Another example would be the histories approach. So, for example, in the Feynman histories approach, where you take histories across from some t initial to some t final, and again the same problems apply. You know, how do you select out this region, and why do we choose to waste, to apply our mathematical machinery everywhere else in a kind of wasteful way when we may be able to just apply it to here? The other sort of approach I think you find in physical theories is what you might call local equations. So a local equation would apply to a point, or at least to a very small region, maybe here. Well, that in itself, it's not clear whether that is F-local or not. You need to say how you go about using your local equations. I'm thinking, for example, of the Einstein field equations or Maxwell's equations or something. You have to say how you go about using those local equations to actually make a prediction pertaining to this region that we're interested in. And I think the methods that we normally have involve choosing some initial space-like hypersurface, imposing initial boundary conditions, and then solving the relevant differential equations. So in that case, we're not proceeding, at least in an F-local fashion. So I think F-locality is a desirable thing to aim for. There's one problem that we have, one hurdle that we're going to have to overcome. You'll notice I was kind of a bit cagey here. I said make relevant assertions rather than calculate. So what I might have said is we can calculate probabilities about a region by considering only objects pertaining to that region. But instead I said make relevant assertions. So here's the problem and the reason I was a bit cagey. So let me illustrate this with an example. Imagine we have three spin measurements that are sequential on the same. Okay, I'm imagining that these are all essentially next to each other. So we have three spin measurements, one after the other, on a spin half particle. And in each case, we have to choose the angle at which we orient our apparatus. And then in each case, we'll get an answer plus or minus a half. So here's something that we can consider. We can ask the question, what is the probability that we'll see spin up on the third spin measurement, given that we measured along the z direction on the third apparatus We measured on along the y direction on the second apparatus, and we got spin down on the second apparatus. So let me write that down. What's the probability of getting spin up on the third apparatus? Given that we got spin down on the second one, that we measured along the z direction on the third one, and we measured along the y direction on the second one. There's a probability that we can consider. And we can calculate that using quantum theory, and the answer is 1/2. So that's one question we could ask. Here's another question we could ask. What is the probability, I'll just write it here above, that we get spin up on the third apparatus, given that we got spin down on the first apparatus, and that we measured the spin along the z direction on the third one and along the x direction on the first one? Okay, so spin up along the x direction. Sorry, spin up on the third apparatus, spin up on the third apparatus, given that we got spin down on the first apparatus, given that we measured spin z on the third apparatus and spin x on the first apparatus. Okay. There's another question we can ask. We can write down this question. What is that probability equal to? Well, we can't answer that question using quantum theory. The reason being that we haven't said what happens in the middle. And any answer you did write down, if you committed yourself to any particular answer to this, I could come along and change what happened in the middle and mess up your answer in a way that I couldn't in the first example. So what's happening here is this probability is well defined. It's given by the theory, but this probability is not well defined, and it's not given by the theory. So what's the difference between those two situations? Well, the difference is to do with the causal structure. In the first example, the two spin measurements are sequential in time, whereas in the second example, the two spin measurements happen one after the other. Sorry, happen with a gap in the middle where you can insert some other apparatus. So the difference is entirely to do with the causal structure. Well, that's fine. So we know how to identify that difference in the context of quantum theory. We've learned what kinds of questions we can ask. We can ask this kind. What kinds of questions we can't ask? We can't ask this kind. And we know that by referring to the causal structure. But what if we have indefinite causal structure? Well, then we don't know how to proceed because you wouldn't know whether we were in a kind of situation where you had well-defined probability or the kind of situation where you didn't. And the only solution to this problem, as far as I can see, is the following. What we need is what I call a two-step approach. In the first step, you look to see if some mathematical criteria, some mathematical criterion, is satisfied such that the probability would be well defined. So, so we have a criteria for the probability being well defined, and then in the second step, we calculate what that probability is if it is well defined. Please.
I think we understand the difference between the two questions. In the first question, how is the second question different from if I take the first question and consider the fourth measurement somewhere in between?
Oh, sorry. I'm imagining that these apparatuses are right up against each other, so there's no possibility of inserting another apparatus in the middle here.
Okay. There's a possibility of modifying the existing measurement. That's what you're doing in the second question.
In the second question, yeah. So in the second question, I consider the region. In the first question, I'm considering this region. In the second question, I'm considering the disjoint region made of these two bits. And the difference is to do with the causal structure. Is that clear?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just a vague question. So doesn't this formula already presuppose that there is this microscopic stuff out there? There already is this.
Yep. So the framework, the approach I'm taking, and again, I don't have time to elaborate on this, is very operational. It's not ontological. I'm not saying let's build a theory up from the bottom out of some, presupposed ontic objects. Rather, I'm saying, imagine you have apparatuses knocking around and you're collecting data. You know, how does your formalization, how does your formalism work with respect to that? That doesn't mean I'm committing myself to operationalism, but rather this is just the methodology.
Well, no, my principle is a bit different, and it's a very important. If you already have this macroscopic stuff out there, don't you sort of already have sort of classical gravitational field around? Is it just a very
impressive? From the mere fact that we have certain types of apparatus around us, we can't infer that we definitely have certain type of physical. We definitely have certain types of theoretical objects in physics. That's not so clear. I think it is the case that any experiment, any attempt to test the theory of quantum gravity, or whatever, will involve doing experiments with classical apparatuses. Can I ask that we don't get in, because there's a whole slew of interpretational questions that sort of, if we go down this line, what I'm attempting to do here is I'm taking a certain methodology. It's an operational methodology, and it's in order to get a mathematical framework. Once we've got that mathematical framework, we may wish to put an ontological interpretation on it, just like the move from Einstein's version of special relativity to Minkowski's version. Yes, please.
A quick point of clarification. If you have indefinite causal structure, doesn't follow from that you will always fail to find the criterion for a well-defined probability?
No, because I think the answer to that is, in the past, we've used the causal structure to help us, to tell us, when the probability is well-defined or not. That's subconsciously, we've been using that type of criteria. But there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to find a more general type of mathematical criteria, which serves the same role. And indeed, I'll show you how that might look in the context of this sort of more general formulation. So this criterion doesn't have to be one that refers to any particular type of causal structure, just some mathematical criteria. We can write it down mathematically. If this is satisfied, then we can calculate this. There's no reason it has to be in terms of, delta x's and delta t's and so on. It doesn't have to be of that nature.
No, it doesn't then imply that you are successful in finding a mathematical criterion before having a well-defined probability. Then, by inference from that, by backward inference, it says that your system somehow works. Because you've just written a rule.
There's a big difference between rule-based and what people normally mean by causal structure. Normally, causal structure is to do with, your space, your sort of structure of space-time.
I'm just thinking of causal structure as something that follows rules.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a broader sense of what one means by causal structure. In that case, sure. But I meant it in the more limited sense of, the kind of causal structure we have, where you have space and time, Okay, maybe I should. Any more brief questions at this point? I'll move on. So when I said F locality and when I mentioned relevant assertions, so now I can slightly modify that. What I want to say is F locality is where we can implement the two-step approach to calculating or to making relevant assertions about probabilities by considering only objects pertaining to the region concerned. So I have this formulation, this formalism, the causaloid formalism. Which is an attempt to implement these kind of ideas. So it's F local, it uses the two-step approach. And so when you have a mathematical criteria for calculating where probabilities are well-defined, and then for actually calculating them if they are well-defined. It's not a time evolution-based picture, it's not a histories-based picture, and it's not a local equations-based picture, at least in the normal understanding of local equations. It's something else. And so what I'm going to do is what I'm going to do is slightly unfair. I'm just going to show you how this looks in quantum theory without providing any real justification. To be fair, I should tell you where it all comes from and then show you how to put quantum theory into this, but I've been giving this talk for a while and I never get to quantum theory. So I figured I'm just going to jump ahead to quantum theory and see how that works. Okay. So here's the sort of system I'm interested in. I'm interested in interacting qubits. So here's a bunch of qubits moving to the left, sorry, to the right. Time goes up. And here's a bunch of qubits moving to the left. Okay, and you get this kind of, and you can extend that as much as you want, and you get this kind of diamond grid lattice. Actually, let me extend it a bit more. Oh yeah, sorry. One thing I should say. So I said this. I developed this framework with the idea of being able to treat theories which don't have definite causal structure. But now I'm going to apply it to quantum theory, where you do have definite causal structure. So in a sense, the motivating reason for developing this theory isn't as clear in quantum theory. Nevertheless, it's interesting to put the theory. To find at least one concrete example of how this framework works out. So we do actually have definite causal structure in this case. Okay. So these are interacting qubits. You could also consider interacting classical bits. And although I won't treat this, you can set the framework also up for that as well. And then at each, we imagine that we have the Hamiltonian is just zero everywhere except where the qubits interact. Okay. So here's all these interaction points. And let me draw one of those a bit bigger. Put a box there. And at each of these interaction points, we can choose what interaction we want. So this is a knob that we set to choose the particular interaction. And then I also imagine we can have a classical output. Okay, that's the classical output. So this is kind of a quantum measurement on two qubits. And let's denote the setting of this apparatus by S and the outcome by A. Okay. And then the other thing I want to introduce is each of these points, we can label each of these points, we can locate them. And this, I'm going to give each point a label. I label them by X. So X is the general label for these points. So this is location X. And I'll put subscripts in there. Okay.
Can you just imagine that while we just have these things happening and forget for a while that we actually have space time and try to see, well, so if you just start talking about this bunch of events happening, what does it mean to have a polish record? Can you think in this way?
In a sense, what
forget for a while.
So in a sense, that's exactly what I'm going to do. Yeah, that's exactly the object of this, is to be able to reason in a way that doesn't have to refer to this underlying causal structure.
Right.
Although I won't, I'll have a limited amount of time to show you that. So in a sense, what we've got now at each of these intersection points, we've got a specification of a setting denoted by S sub X, and then we've got an outcome. And that's our data. Our data is, at each of these little points is this. And if I take a bigger region, like this, here's a big. I could have made it disjoint as well. The regions don't have to be, so to speak, don't have to be connected in this way. Let me call that region 1. Imagine the x's in that region belong to some set O1. Well, let me just define these two quanta. I'll define S1. Is all the SXs, is just the ordered, is just a set of all the SXs. I should have to write this, I guess, like this. I'm not sure if my mathematical notation is exactly right here. Okay, so this is just, S1 is just the list of settings for each position X inside the set corresponding to this region. Okay. And also A1 is a similar thing. Which one? Sorry. Yeah. It's math cal O, I think. Okay, and then one more piece of notation. Alpha. I wanted to find alpha x, which is just this is just s x a x. So if you like, this is the prescription of a particular setting along with a particular outcome. Okay. And then alpha 1 is just a set of those. So if you know alpha 1, then what you're specifying is the choice of knobs, the choice of knob settings in a particular region, and then then a particular set of outcomes. Okay. So here's now the sort of thing we'd like to be able to calculate. We'd like to be able to calculate the probability that we see some particular outcomes in, say, region 2, given that we saw particular outcomes in region 1, and given that we have particular, choices of settings in regions 2. There's a very general sort of thing we could ask to calculate. So the question is, can we write down a formalism for being able to predict these kinds of things? Okay. Any questions? Because I've just introduced a whole bunch of notation. It's all clear. Yeah. Region 2, and then we're just asking, basically, what's the probability of data 2 given data 1, pretty much. Just fleshing this out a bit. Okay. So now I'm going to tell you how it works in broad terms. I'm not going to go into the details. So associated with any region, we have a matrix. Here's the matrix. And it's a rectangular matrix. Actually, in principle, it could be a very rectangular matrix. This alpha runs over all the possible alphas in the region that we're interested in. Okay, so this is the matrix for region 1. This alpha runs over all the possible alphas in that region. Okay, you can imagine that's the horizontal axis of the matrix. Then this K1 is a subset of these alphas, which I'm going to call a fiducial subset. It's a minimal set which is sufficient for what I want to do. And it belongs to some subset, which I'll denote omega 1. So omega 1 is a subset of all the possible alphas, and I call it a fiducial subset. Okay. In a sense, this subset is sufficient to characterize what goes on in region 1. Okay. And I could expand out this Okay, so if I just expand out alpha 1, just write down all the x's which have subscripts belonging to this set up here, and likewise for the subscript, then I would have something that looks like this that has a whole string of subscripts and a whole string of superscripts.
So is there an abuse of notation?
Usually in my papers there's an abuse of notation.
You're saying omega 1 is a subset of something?
Yeah, so omega 1 is a subset of all the possible alphas. So if I was to write down the set, if I was to write down the set of all possible alphas,
which you haven't done yet,
which I haven't done. Well, I should give it a name. I can just never think of an appropriate letter. Let's call it A. Okay, A1. So that's the set of all possible alphas. Then omega 1 is a subset of that. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm using my voice key now. Voice key 1
is A. So I haven't. So it's a particular subset. So K1 is a label chosen from a particular subset.
Oh, okay, right.
Of all the alphas, yeah. So we choose there's a particular type. So actually, this choice isn't unique, but one can make a choice, a kind of minimal choice of subset. I mean, I haven't properly explained where this is coming from, so it won't be completely clear, but I want to just show the basic shape of the mathematics. But it's going to be some very small subset of the full set. So, I mean, in the case of quantum theory, if you have the quantum theory just for a single qubit, so actually, well, this is here you have pairs of qubits interacting. Well, yeah, let's take pairs of qubits. So if you take this case, and you just take one small region, so if my region is just one of these elementary regions, then the alpha label runs over all the interactions plus outcomes you could think of, which is a very large set. The only thing that would keep it finite is experimental imprecision. Whereas it turns out that the k indices only need to run over the Hilbert space dimension here to the power 4. So that would be 4 to the power 4. Okay. So that's a fairly small set in comparison. Okay, so these matrices are kind of the essential thing that we need to be able to make predictions. So let me hope you've got all that notation clear so I can go on to the next page. So now, so remember I had these matrices. So now I just want to introduce some new notation. This is really just equivalent notation, but I prefer it for some purposes. So I'm going to imagine, I guess, that the all the components of this at a certain value of alpha form a vector, and this is the vector. Okay, so this is the K1th component of that vector. Okay, it's just different notation. Okay. So of course, one thing I can do is really alpha is just the labels pertaining to all the x's inside some region O. I could consider this kind of thing. Okay, where really this is now just a bigger region, and I split the labels into two bits, the labels in region 1 and the labels in region 2, and this is the matrix for that larger region, R1 and R2. It's the same kind of thing. And likewise, I can get my this. So this is just the same thing where I've expanded this a bit. Okay, so now... No. So what's interesting, it can be, but actually generically it is, but in special cases it will be, it will, in special cases, these labels will run over fewer indices than the tensor product of this one.
Will there be a non-null intersection of these sets?
So generically, so in general, if you take the labels in set 1 and the labels in set 2 and form the Cartesian product, well, this has to be true always, but in special cases, there will actually be a subset. They can also be. So now here's how you implement the two-step procedure that I was talking about. And I'm sorry this is a bit obscure because I'm just jumping into the mathematical formalism without telling you where it comes from. But this was the thing I wanted to get to. What we do is we define these two vectors, R alpha 1 and alpha 2, and then this vector, R alpha 1 bar, which is defined. So this one is already given. I've already told you how to get this vector. This vector is the sum of R alpha 1 beta 2 where I'm summing over all beta 2 which are consistent with the setting that we had in region 2 but summing over all the different outcomes. So this is a fixed setting in region 2 but summing over all the outcomes. Okay, that's a vector one can define. Good. So here's the two-stage thing. So the first stage is stage one. The probability, I should say what probability? It's basically the same as the probability I had before. The probability of this probability of alpha 2 given, sorry, a probability of A2 given A1 and S1 and S2. This probability is well defined if and only if R alpha 1 alpha 2 is parallel to R alpha 1 bar. And then in the case where this parallel condition is satisfied, the probability is then given by so this is the probability we're trying to calculate. It's given by this equation. In other words, the probability is just the ratio of the lengths of these two vectors. Okay. So I've sort of
10 minutes.
10 minutes. Okay.
During discussion.
Yeah. So actually, what I've said so far isn't really particular to quantum theory. It's particular. It would also work in pretty much in the generic case. Let me now talk about something which is particular to quantum theory and also works for classical probability theory.
Sorry, I'm thinking of this point. Why just defines that definition? Why is it well defined?
Oh, sorry, I haven't. I'm just presenting formalism, so I'm not accounting for the formalism at this stage.
Okay.
So I'm just saying, these are the mathematical objects that appear in the formalism,
yeah.
And here's how it works. But you'll notice that this is F local. Now we're only referring to mathematical objects that pertain to the given region in order to be able to say, first of all, that the property is well-defined and then what it's equal to. So this mathematical criterion doesn't look like it has a lot to do with space-time a priori. It's just a mathematical condition we can write down. Of course, one may be able to decode it and make it in the context of a theory that has definite causal structure and reinterpret it as something to do with space-time. But look, just on the face of it, it's just a mathematical condition we can write down. And the same mathematical condition may apply in a context where we don't really have space and time in the usual sense. Okay. So it's these matrices that we need to know in order to be able to implement this two-stage approach. These are kind of central to everything. But if you look, there's actually quite a lot of these matrices because we need one of these matrices for every conceivable region that we could choose. And if you have, say, n regions, then the number of regions that you can choose up to regions goes exponential in n. So it's a very large number of regions. And if that was the end of it, that would be very unfortunate. But it turns out in the case of quantum theory and also classical probability theory, we have classical bits interacting in the same way. It turns out that you don't need to have to specify an exponential number of these matrices. In fact, I'll just draw this diagram again. Okay, I'll just take the rest of the dots as given. In fact, what you need to specify is one matrix for each of these dots. One for each dot. And also one matrix for each of the links. And the matrix for the links has a slightly different appearance. Okay, maybe I'm... So just ignore that for the moment. Sorry, this is getting a bit messy. So for each dot, you have to specify one matrix. And then for each link, you have to specify another matrix. Let me just draw a square around it. Okay, for each link, you have to specify one of these. And that's it. That's all you have to specify. And once you've got this, then using certain identities that apply in the case of quantum theory and also classical probability theory, you can calculate all the other matrices. So you can calculate the general matrices. So for example, I may have a matrix pertaining to some incredibly strange region consisting of disparate parts. So here's a matrix, here's a region that I can consider. Just by having this number of matrices, which is linear in the number of these x's, that I can calculate the matrix from an arbitrary region. Okay, and I'm not going to show you how to do that. That's just how the machinery works out. So let me... Oh, and... Yeah, okay, so I won't go into more detail because there's a lot. One could talk about this for a long time. But let me just finally try to link this up a bit with standard quantum theory. So remember we had two qubits interacting. We had choice of knob setting, which was S sub X, and then we had some classical outcome, which was A sub X. Well, then associated with that is a set of super operators, which all have the same settings, all have the same superscript S sub X, but have different outcome labels. So associated with a fixed setting is a set of super operators running over the label for the outcomes. So for those of you who aren't familiar with super operators are maps on density matrices that take the incoming density matrix to the outgoing density matrix. And then an example of a set like this would be the projection operators. So for example, the map that rho goes to P AX SX rho P So for each different outcome you project the original density matrix in a different way. So that's one example of a super operator, but there are more general examples than that. So that's what we have. And now, in order to calculate these objects, we do it in terms of these super operators. So what we do is for each region X. So this region X, we can choose a set of operators, which. How do I write this? Which span the space of allowed operators. Okay, so this is a linear spanning set of super operators that span the set of allowed super operators at that place. And you need to have n to the power 4 of them. That's the number of entries in the super operator. And then we want to be able to calculate this. Well, we can calculate this using this equation. We just take a general super operator corresponding to a particular alpha label. And that can be written as a sum of this particular spanning set. So this is how quantum theory is getting injected into this framework. And then there's something else we need to be able to calculate. This was for the points. There's something else we need to be able to calculate for the links, a similar looking equation. I dived into the mathematics a bit. I just wanted to show you how the framework looked without justifying it. but what we can see is we do have an approach which is F local. So in particular, the approach we have is not a time evolution picture. We don't here have a quantum state that evolves forward in time, and we use that to make predictions. It's nothing like that. It's not a histories-based picture. We don't have to specify histories, you know, over some time interval from t initial to t final. And also, we don't really have local equations. We have something a bit different than Maxwell's equations or Einstein's field equations. But we see explicitly how we end up implementing this kind of criteria. And so I think given that there are very strong reasons that F locality is something we want in the case of quantum gravity because we have indefinite causal structure, I think this kind of approach is going to be the right way to go about building a mathematical framework for quantum gravity. And I'll stop there.
Of the double slit experiment that you didn't want to have to commit to asking the question which slit it went through.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, later you're assigning a matrix to a link. And the link, as you described it,
mm-hmm.
was the path from one apparatus to the next.
Okay.
So as those links smear out, how do you tell one link from the next?
Okay, So really what I wanted to do was to show how to set up this framework, at least in one realization of one interesting quantum system. I should have mentioned this is an interesting quantum system because you can do universal quantum computation with it, so you can simulate arbitrary quantum processes up to some accuracy. So
when you said you're doing a link, you really just meant adjacent pairs.
Yeah, so you still have the kind of essential quantum thing going on because you're not specifying what the spin is along that link. So rather than having superposition in position, a position basis, I still have superposition in the spin basis or the qubit basis. And that's where my quantum uncertainty is in this example. I might try instead to set up this framework for a single particle or a number of particles just moving freely through space. And one could attempt to do that. I haven't done that.
Wouldn't the links all blur together into one big link at that point?
Well, without saying that this particle goes from here to here, yeah. And I think that wouldn't be a difficult thing to do. At least, well, modulo the fact that this is discrete, you'd have to make the problem a bit discrete. But other than that, I think it would be very easy to set up that for that case. So the answer really is that rather than having the quantum uncertainty and path taken in that first example, the uncertainty in this example is in the qubit quantum variable.
In before you come to the theory in the lab, you just have these data sets. Presumably, you have someone's written on their pad sitting and then accumulates some data.
Yeah, yeah.
And from that alone, you can construct these matrices. Is that the idea?
Yes. Yeah, so
sufficient sampling of.
That's right. Yeah, you could imagine some guy who just collects that kind of data and then doing it a sufficient number of times, he could construct those matrices. Yeah.
is this sort of general formalism sufficiently general that you might get something other than either quantum mechanics or classical mechanics?
For sure, yeah. Okay, maybe to be 100% certain, I should actually go about explicitly constructing examples.
Right.
But it's a very, very broad general framework.
So the construct examples means to construct relations between conditional probabilities?
So to construct an example means to construct a minimal way of calculating these lambda matrices.
This is probably a very bad question because I don't understand the Euler principle well, but so you're saying F locality is something that's good for quantum gravity, but then we've got people like Susskind saying that holographic, for example, is a good thing for gravity. Obviously, that says that the information is on the boundary, not in the
right.
region itself.
Yeah.
Can you square these two things?
I think this goes back to what I was saying at the beginning. We're in a a territory where we are trying to construct theories. You know, and we don't necessarily care how we get there. We're just going to try and do our best. And so I think you can have, you know, principles that look very different. If they end up converging on the same theory in the end, then maybe they weren't something compatible. Certainly, this is not a holographic approach. Here, I'm thinking about making measurements in the bulk and how you might correlate them, rather than measurements of some asymptotically defined region. I think this is partly an attitude that comes from thinking about quantum computers. Or just the computational model in general, which is a great model, but it's not one that's so common in many areas of theoretical physics. Usually people just think we have to say what comes in and what goes out, and that's all you need to say. Whereas here, you kind of have lots of mini things going in and coming out with data being collected everywhere. I think that's a much better model for the way sort of the world appears to us.
I'm afraid that time is over. I think we can thank Lucien again.
Thank you.
And our next speaker is Lucien's neighbour in Waterloo, Steve Weinstein from University of Waterloo. Is it working now?
10 feet away.
And Steve is going to. Steve is going to talk about EPR correlations and
statistical independence. It's a little bit different from what I put on the abstract. Is this the pointer? Is this the pointer?
I don't know.
What is this?
There's a little black button on the side.
I know. We need a very long hockey stick. Where a black button
on that thing you have?
Yeah, it's
another one. Oh, I see. Oh, look at that. All right, good. I got it. Thank you. All right. Good. Well, thank you. Thank you, Guido and Hugh and Lucien, for inviting me to talk about my exciting new work. I spoke about this a couple of weeks ago at Perimeter, but on something closely related to this, I hope this will be of interest to people who are at that talk, as the ideas have evolved considerably since then, and the presentation is quite a bit different. So, let's see. What I wanted to do is talk about the assumption of statistical independence in the derivations of Bell's theorem, something which has been questioned by many people, in particular Hugh, who associates dropping statistical independence with retrocausation. This topic is obviously very controversial. I lose a lot of people right after mentioning that. No, that's all right. Okay, so I'll give you a little overview of the talk. So the Bell's theorem is commonly understood to show that the EPR correlations are not explainable via a local hidden variable theory, where local means something technical, means that the theory satisfies strong Bell locality. Bell's theorem assumes, however, that the initial state of the particles, or whatever you want to conceive of the initial state describing, particles, fields, or whatever, the initial state lambda is independent of the final detector settings, A and B, so that the probability of lambda given A and B is identical to the probability of lambda. So it's all. In other words, that the probability of a given state is not changed by your knowledge that the settings of the detector at each wing. Okay, it's been proposed that this independence assumption might be undermined by backward causation, and I'm going to motivate this a little bit and discuss what I think is a kind of compelling line of reasoning given by Hugh and by others about that might lead us to question this assumption. Banning the temporal bias, whereby we seek explanations in the past but not the future for present correlations, will examine what happens if we drop statistical independence And we're going to discuss two sorts of dependence, all right, two sorts of non-independence, which I call weak and strong, and show, I think, that weak dependence violates the Bell inequalities while strong dependence does not. This is not a very good sentence, but necessarily strong dependence involves non-local correlations which do not arise dynamically. And finally, we're going to discuss, assuming I have some time, a couple of examples. This I did discuss at Parameter. I think interesting examples of classical relativistic theories with such non-local correlations. So theories which are classical relativistic theories in which it might be quite natural to have something like what I'm calling strong dependence. Okay, so just to sort of see where this all comes from, just take a quick look at the derivation of the Bell inequality. I'm looking at the Clauser, Holt, Horn, Shimony version to remind ourselves how this assumption comes into play. As I said in the beginning, I'm going to assume with Bell strong locality, meaning that the expectation values A bar and B bar for a single measurement at detectors A and B depend only on the local detector setting, respectively A and B, and the hidden state lambda. So strong locality implies that A bar is a function of A and lambda, and B bar is a function only of B and lambda. So given the above, the expectation value for the product of the outcomes of measurements at A and B in a single, I don't know why I put in a single trial. It's not in a single trial. The expectation value is given by that, and which is just the product of the weighted product of the expectation values in a given state. So you take expected value in A and lambda and B and lambda and weight it by the probability of lambda given A and B. This is in general. And it's assumed that the theory in question or something is giving us P of a lambda, this conditional probability.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah,
why
sure.
Why is only P of coming back? It's only P of lambda which is dependent on both A and B. But if you have radical causality, you can think that the outcomes could naturally, in a locally causal way, but radical causal way.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm going to discuss. Right. Exactly. Okay. Good. Yes. I guess this is one of the things that's changed since I spoke about this 2 weeks ago. I've been in the same building with Hans, and I caught these brain waves, and I intuited his questions, and I decided to address them directly in this talk. Perhaps incorrectly, but I'm addressing the questions. I may give you the wrong answers retrocausally. No, not retrocausally. So the Bell inequality, the Bell CHHS inequality is this. It's just a function of the expectation values with various detector settings. I think this is probably old hat to the quantum foundations community here. Now, the beginning, this is all that we're going to need. The beginning of the derivation goes as follows. You start out with this and write it, just write it out like this. This is just taking the original expression for EAB and E and EAB prime. Here, okay, and then add these two terms, okay? So ordinarily, what Bell does is this P, he assumes that P lambda AB and P lambda AB prime B prime, and these four terms are all the same. They're all P lambda, and that P lambda is out front. If P lambda is out front, this is quite straightforward. Because this minus this equals zero. So you can add these terms indiscriminately. But the second step, as I've written it, with the conditional probability written out, is only valid if P lambda, if these two conditional probabilities are equal to these two. In other words, these two terms only cancel if this times this equals this times this. Is that clear? Okay, that's where it comes in. That's where why Bell is assuming. Well, it's certainly what the assumption that P lambda is equal to all of these things. If you assume that, then you don't have to worry about this complication. If you don't assume that these are equal, and why would they be a priori, then you can't really go anywhere this is invalid. You have to start modifying this term and this term so that they do cancel, and you get a big mess. Try it if you like. So the point here is just that P lambda AB is equal to P lambda is sufficient, but perhaps not necessary. In other words, perhaps there might be some residual dependence on A or B. On a weaker condition whereby P lambda AB is proportional to P lambda A, P lambda B might suffice. So I want to consider that. And I want to consider basically ways of weakening statistical independence and see, try to motivate and characterize them, and then briefly to consider the effect of this kind of weakening. Okay, so this is the usual EPR setup in my rendition. DL and DR are just detectors, these little world tubes, the color indicating their orientation. So you see I have a detector here whose setting is changed right up here, and so it changes color. This is rather inessential, but it's just a graphic way of representing the relevant variables. L and R are particles, and the color indicates their properties, which by assumption, in conjunction with the detector settings, determine the outcomes indicated by the gray and the black boxes. So the outcome, the color of the box, is going to be a function of this color and this color. That's really what strong locality is telling us, that this color of this box is not a function of this color or this color, the red or the black. That's parameter independence, and that's outcome independence. Okay, that's all by the way. Now, this is EPR backward. And this is a good motivation for thinking about dropping statistical independence. If you invert this diagram and you look at it backward in time, then of course, if you're like me, you reverse right and left. Of course, there's a whole philosophical literature which discusses what time reversal really should be, and some people think that it should include time reversal, includes parity reversal and charge conjugation. I'm not going to take sides on that. Not important. So what this looks like, though, is it looks like a pair of sources. So the detectors are kind of absorbers of particles. Flip it around. What do you have? Is you have something here emitting a particle here and emitting a particle here and having them join up here. And it seems natural, given this perspective, which is, after all, just a change in perspective on the exact same situation we were considering before, it would seem reasonable to think that the particle properties here might be correlated with the settings of the detectors, of the things that were emitting them, the properties of the things that were emitting them. Okay? I mean, ordinarily, if we think of somebody has a little box and they have a little switch on it and they change the position of the switch, then the thing coming out of the box, the properties of the thing coming out of the box might change. Certainly plausible. With me so far? Questions? Okay, that's the motivation. Sorry, I inadvertently included two different kinds of transitions here. I'm a Beamer novice. So we might suppose it's a kind of a mock-up of just the situation we're looking at. It's this kind of weak dependence. And this is how I've schematized it. There are two possible particle states. red and green associated with each source, one for each switch setting. So lambda A is the particle coming out of, never mind these colors. This will be lambda A, and this will be, you can think of this as lambda B. And lambda A can be red or green if the switch A1 is set to A1, then lambda A is red. This is just a straightforward deterministic kind of correlation. A2, if the switch is A2, then the particle coming out of A is going to be a G. Similarly, B1, if B is set to B1, you get R, and B is set to B2, lambda B is equal to G. Then the composite, the full state lambda is just the composite, or the ordered pair here, lambda A comma lambda B. So it can be one of RR, RG, GR, or GG. So the probability that lambda A has the value R if A is set to A1 is 1. The probability that lambda B has the value G if B is set to B1 is 0. Okay, that's correct. What was I doing? So if it's B1, lambda B is R. Only if it's B2 is it G. If we assume that all the source settings, A1, B1, A1, B2, etc., are equally likely, then the probability of lambda simpliciter is 1/4. All of these are equally likely. Now, of course, in these sorts of, when you're considering relaxing statistical independence, it's essential that you think about the sensitivity of the total distribution of states to the detector settings, since after all what you're proposing is that the detector settings are either influencing or completely determining the states. So if you don't move the detectors, or in this case we're thinking of them as sources that change the source settings, you're always going to get the same thing. Okay? So P lambda doesn't equal P lambda AB. This is so we violate a statistical independence. For instance, probability of an RR is 1/4, but the probability of RR given A and B, given the two switch settings, is either going to be 1 or 0. And note that the probability of lambda AB is equal to the product of the probabilities of the these marginal distributions, which essentially means that these things are uncorrelated. Now, this is a special case. What I want to do is just quickly generalize this. Consider a generalization of weak dependence, which has the twin virtues of not insisting that lambda admit a decomposition into lambda A and lambda B, and not unrelated, potentially allowing for lambda to encode correlations between the outcomes. So I'm going to consider a revised but a quite similar function for the, here it is, the intermittent. P lambda AB is equal to the product of these two marginals divided by probability of lambda, which is acts really here as a kind of a normalization. You'll see how this works in the same example in a second. Where P lambda, incidentally, is for consistency, it's this, which is equal to this. So the probability of lambda given A1 times the probability of A1 plus the probability of lambda given A2 plus the probability of A2. Right? That's the total probability of lambda. And that has to equal this. Good, so let's apply this to the previous example. So same example, different language. Lambda, as before, is equal to RR, RG, GR, or GG. but now we're going to associate A1 not with a particular part of lambda, but with a kind of a probabilistic choice between two possibilities for lambda. So A1 is essentially just picking out the first of the pair. So here we're going to say that A1 implies either RR or RG. And we're going to assume that these probabilities are a half to match up with what we did before. Probability of if the probability of lambda given A1 and the probability of lambda given A2 each take values or one half or zero depending on lambda. So probability of RR given A1 is equal to a half because A1 is equally likely to lead to RR or RG. And so that's also equal to the probability of RG given A1. The probability of RR given A2 is zero because A2 implies that the first member here is an R and this is a G. Okay, the total probability of a given state, lambda here, so is given by this expression. So I just spelled out what I said before here. Just in passing, I might note this depends on the frequencies of the detector settings. So as expected, as designed, the probability of lambda does not equal to the probability of lambda given AB. So the probability of RR is a quarter, while the probability of RR given A1 and B1, given that the settings are this and this, is equal to 1. So if you know what the settings are, then you fully determine the state. If you don't know the settings, the probability is just 1 quarter, is a random distribution. So to the conclusion of this first part is weak dependence. I'm not going to give this an extensive treatment right now, but is it compatible with quantum mechanics? No. And intuitively, the reason is that by allowing free influence or independent influence of the state by each wing, by varying the settings on each wing, you can look at this in the forward direction or the backward direction. What you're doing is you're jeopardizing the existence of any meaningful correlations between the wings, let me leave it at that for now. Okay, so Bell states, for instance, give perfect EPR state, as discussed by Bohm. The spin version gives perfect correlations for certain choices of A and B. In other words, given this is really a, I'm assuming here, as is often done, that the values of the two possible outcomes on each wing are plus one or minus one. So the product of the two at any given run of the experiment is going to be plus one or minus one. And this is the expected value for the product over the course of many runs, given these two detector settings. Okay, so we have perfect correlations, but we also know that the marginal probabilities in a given state, with a given detector setting, are zero. Okay, so you get as many plus ones as you do minus ones on each wing. But you know that assuming the detectors are set appropriately, assuming that A and B are parallel, that a plus one here is matched with a plus one here and a minus one here and a minus match with a minus one here, and so on. Okay, so weak dependence tells us this, that we can write the expectation value in this form, that the it's essentially a weighted. Well, it's not really, it's not a product of the marginals, but these things make up the marginals. It's just the probability of lambda given A times the expectation value of A and lambda probability of lambda given B times expectation value of B given setting B and lambda summed over the total set lambda. So, argument is fairly simple. Given a given a function A bar, A lambda, pick a P lambda A such that the sum over lambda of P lambda A times this, so that this is equal to zero, okay? So we have some function A bar of the A's and lambdas, which takes a lambda and a detector setting and tells us what the likelihood, what the expected outcome is. So take that and rig up a P lambda A such that you get this right, okay? So that the expectation value of this marginal is zero. There's no preference for plus one or minus one. Since we're given these, by the theory, this tightly constrains P lambda B, okay? If we want this to come out to one. So for instance, if P lambda I given A, so lambda I is just one of the particular states, does not equal zero, and A bar A lambda I is equal to minus one, then we know that if B bar is equal to, of B lambda I is equal to one, this had better be zero, or else this thing is not going to add up to give us one. The point being that P lambda A and P lambda B are not independent after all, so the joint probability can't take this form. This effectively, writing it in this form is only valid if we assume that these things are independent. Okay, so the upshot of this is that weak dependence, rather than helping you overcome the Bell inequalities, makes it it's even harder. In other words, the Bell inequalities tell you that classical correlations are weaker than quantum correlations. What I'm arguing here is that adding weak dependence makes weak correlations weaker still. So what I want to do then is now look at strong dependence. And I just want to look at it first by looking at a model, just to illustrate what strong dependence is. I'm not totally comfortable, I should say, with the describing these as weak and strong dependence, and you may get a sense of that. Not a sense of my discomfort, but a sense of why I'm not comfortable with it, as you see what these models reveal. So this breaks statistical independence in such a way that P lambda A and P lambda B carry no information at all about P lambda A and B. So before, with weak dependence, basically if I knew these marginal probabilities, if I knew the dependence P lambda given A and P lambda given B, I could construct P lambda given A and B. Here, in this model, excuse me, I'm totally out of luck with respect to that. So P lambda A, this is not equal to P lambda, but it's in other words, statistical independence is broken, but in a different way. Let's just leave it at that for now. So the model is lambda equals the same four pairs, but here what we're looking at is, okay, we're looking at some sort of pairwise determination of possible states, and what you have is if the two detectors or sources or whatever you want to call these things are set the same meaning that this number is the same. So if we have A1 B1 or A2 B2, then you have either a double R or a double G. If you have A2 B1 or A1 B2, you have RG or GR. Okay. So, right, yes. So we'll suppose that each of the two possible outcomes are compatible with a given pair of detector settings are equally likely, so that the probability of lambda given AB is going to be either a half or zero. So we'll assume that the probability of RR given A1, B1 is a half, and the probability of this is a half. It's just what you might sort of expect. Nothing sneaky. So the overall distribution of states is now going to be, did I write this correctly? Yes, I did. This is the probability of lambda AB, lambda given A and B, times the weighted probability with the weighted by the probability of whatever of that combination A and B. I'm allowing for possible correlations here. This doesn't necessarily, I'm not assuming here that this is PA times PB. So as before, the overall distribution of states P lambda is going to depend on the detector settings via this. And if all pairs of settings are equally likely, so that PAB is equal to 1/4 for all A and B, then P lambda is a half for all lambda.
What's an interesting probability issue, your choices of?
Actually, there's a probability of a lambda equal a half. That doesn't. Probably it must be a quarter, yes. What was the question?
What does it mean to assign a probability to the choice of particular settings? I'm going to choose it, choose whatever I want.
Yeah.
So what's it mean to say probability?
What it means then, it's a good question. What it means is that, yes, your choice is just a frequency then. So it's in a given run of the experiment, you make some choices. There's a certain distribution of A and B. And that influences the distribution of states, lambda, which is something you have to have if you have lambda depend. If lambda has some sort of functional dependence on the detector settings, then obviously. That probability is a frequency, yes. That's how I view it, and I think that's a perfectly sensible way to view it. In fact, I'm not sure, I don't know how you would view it. Epistemically.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't really, yeah, right. Yeah, good.
But then that P of lambda defining there is not, every experiment does not have that P of lambda. You're saying if you average over all experiments, then you happen to average over all the potential.
Mm-hmm.
Then that's what P of lambda. But for any given experiment, P of lambda is not going to be that.
Mm-hmm. Well, P of A and B, right. I mean, the other thing that's sort of up in the air is P of lambda is a function of both this, and this is the thing you have that changes experiment to experiment. This thing arguably doesn't. Guido.
Do you need to consider the probabilities of the settings? All you need to consider is the conditional probabilities of lambda on certain settings.
Right.
Whether these conditional probabilities are different with different settings or are the same.
Yeah.
So maybe you can have a little discussion without bothering about the probability of.
Yeah, well, this is actually why I describe this as a kind of a normalization. I mean, arguably, it washes out because this probability is sensitive to these. Okay, so in the given experiment, we can change these frequencies, but then we're also, along with it, changing the probability of a given lambda.
But that's one.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Let's see. Let me keep. Right. So this is wrong. All right. So in general, it's not. In some cases, not true. But in general, P lambda does not equal P lambda given A and B. So probability here of RR given A1 B2 over here is zero. But the probability of lambda, which is the probability, is equal to the probability of lambda given A. Which means that the detector setting on a single wing provides no information at all about the state. So the probability of RR is a quarter, and the probability of RR given A1, B2 is zero. Okay, so this is what I'm calling strong dependence. And this is how I'm interpreting it. Strong dependence implies that the state, in a sense, mediates correlations between the detector settings. So this is one way to look at it. In other words, given a state and given a setting B of detector B, little b of detector B, we have non-trivial information about the setting of A. And this lack of freedom in specifying the local properties of a system is, it's been characterized differently by a lot of people. This is really what people are thinking of most of the time when they're thinking of dropping statistical independence. It's something like this strong dependence, and it's called, it goes by the name conspiracy theories, retrocausal theories. There's something funny about, something different about the distribution of the data at a given instant, about the state of the various objects which are in play. And how I want to characterize it, and I think this is, it doesn't bring in a lot of loaded conceptual analysis, is it's a lack of freedom in, as I say, in the setting of the properties, in the lambda and the two detector settings. These are regarded as not being individually freely variable. And this is at odds with what people call the well-posedness of ordinary relativistic systems of equations, though it doesn't contradict relativity. And I'll show you a couple of examples of that in a minute. However, this is what I want, one of the things I want to sort of throw in because I'm in Sydney and also because I think it's interesting. It does block any sort of counterfactual analysis of causation, retro or otherwise. In other words, so I'll just mention this briefly. One way of thinking about this kind of situation, which is, I think, I hope I don't mischaracterize Hugh's way of thinking, is that what's going on here is that there's some sort of, one can think about the situation as a free choice of a detector setting over here affecting having a backwards influence about a choice here affects what particle goes into the past, okay? What the properties are of what we would ordinarily regard as the particle arriving at the detector. So it's as if we're now turning the temporal orientation around and regarding this detector as a source, and it's emitting into what we were before regarding as the past. So now this is characterized as causal, and I want to suggest that there's at least a problem in thinking of it as causal, because in an ordinary analysis of causation in this kind of setup, this kind of situation, which is a sort of a relativistic situation where relativistic local physics holds, what you would do is you would analyze the truth value of that causal claim by analyzing what would have happened if you had done otherwise over here, if you had set the detector differently or not touched the detector and left everything else the same. Okay, but if you have this kind of strong dependence, you have this kind of non-local correlation, and what you can't do is you can't change something here and leave everything else the same. All right, this is probably the one place I really could have used something to look at, but it's the one place I don't have it. Ken?
When you say everything else, you are including the hidden variable lambda.
Uh-huh.
and it's hidden.
Yeah.
Well,
surely, of course, you can't do that because it's exactly the thing you're changing. So you can't hold it fixed because that is what's changing. So it's a contradiction from the start. If you say, I'm going to hold it fixed, I'm going to have my choice here change that, change hold it fixed. So it's just because.
Well, yeah, no, it's a good point. I mean, the what you would have to do is you have to either.
What I'm saying that you
yeah.
can still talk about causation, you just don't need to hold that fixed. That's exactly the thing that you're causing.
It's the thing that you're causing. But
you
there
you. Change, exactly. So you can't
well, on what the question. Right, but then that's just words there, right? The question is in virtue of what would you say that this detector setting is causing the particle? Okay, this is what I'm getting at. Right, I mean,
because of this global constraint that you have.
Right. Let's come back to this in the discussion because I have a couple of examples which maybe will make this a little bit clearer about how, I do think that there are some difficulties in, you do have a different sort of situation in any case. What the impact is for the analysis of causality is something we're not going to settle in 2 minutes in the middle of my talk. I wanted to throw this out there because you do ordinarily in an ordinary relativistic setting, you do avail yourself of this freedom to manipulate degrees of freedom locally. You avail yourself of in a way you're not, then the complication that's coming out here is in what this freedom consists is not entirely clear because after all you're describing a deterministic world. But the idea is, okay, you have, usually, you've had a state evolve up to the present, and then you, so you pick some surface, and then you say, okay, well, what can I do here? I could shut my computer down because I'm talking too much. You have a surface, and then you can take the data at that moment, change one little bit of it here, and then consider what difference that makes to the future evolution. All right, that's the kind of thing you can't do in a retrocausal, strongly correlated, strongly dependent, whatever you want to call it, theory. And so that's lost, and that's certainly different. Whether or not one can still have some sort of meaningful analysis of local causation is something I can't really claim to resolve right here, right now. But I wanted to throw it out there, and it's obviously interesting because two of you guys have pushed on it, which is great. Okay, so I wanted to discuss a couple of theories which have this property. So this is just a picture of a one-by-one dimensional space-time, which is wrapped up in the time direction. And what do we got here? X, T, so T just sort of wraps around here. So this is a whirl line of a particle. And, you know, the claim here is that this is impossible. This is not a possible space-time. In other words, one possible space-time would be if I would have a possible space-time if I had no particles, okay? Empty space all the way around. I'm assuming some sort of general relativistic dynamics or kinematics for the particle. There's no real non-trivial dynamics here. Okay, but if I stick a particle in here and it follows an inertial trajectory, then it's going to wrap around and do this, okay? This is possible. So the idea here is that if I have a particle and they're acted on by no forces at one point, and it's moving in the x direction with some velocity given by the angle of that whirl line, then I necessarily have a particle here, a particle here, a particle here, a particle here, and so on, moving with the same velocity. And this is arguably just the sort of thing that you have in a theory with strong dependence. Okay, and one of the things you can't do, what you can't do, is you can't say, well, okay, what would happen if I this thing is very intermittent. If this particle here were moving with a different velocity, or just say if this particle weren't here, okay, what would the world look like? Well, the entire, this whole surface would be completely different. All right? So this is, there's nothing, well, there's something funny going on, and there's nothing funny going on. There's nothing funny with regard to relativity, but there is this strong consistency condition that you always have when you have closed time-like curves. And these are particularly, sometimes some models with closed time-like curves, the curves are only closed if they're accelerated, as that's in the Gödel universe. Only accelerated curves close in along themselves. This thing is closed for inertial particles, and it's due to the topological structure of the space-time. Okay, and this is another example, completely different sort of non-locality. This is, what we're looking at here is time-like initial data for the wave equation. So what I'm considering here is this equation, the simple wave, relativistic wave equation in 2 plus 1 space-time dimensions. Okay, and I'll give you the motivation for this in a minute. this is x, this is y, this is t. So this is the ordinary domain of dependence of E. In other words, if you were to talk about the domain of dependence of E, you would have in mind something like the shaded area, or any shaded area, just a cross-section of the past light cone. Or you could look at the future light cone if you wanted to. And that does indeed determine E. So if I know the field in this region, then I know the field here, given this equation. But it's also the case, it is not as well known, something I've been working on a bit, but the basics of this go back to the 30s and investigations of Fritz John and others. It's also true that a region, there's a space-like region, or space-like and just barely null on the corners here, R also fully determines E. Okay. Now this is, where did that hand come from? Okay. Go right out and buy yourself a Windows machine. I highly recommend them. The surprises every day. This region can be as narrow as you like. Now, the relevance of this to our problem, okay, aside from the fact that it's a very funny kind of dependence, is that this data is not freely specifiable. Okay, so the data here uniquely determines this, but it can't be specified independently. Okay, so that the data, you can't just take any old data here and here and here and here and here and smoothly connect it and hope that it's a part of a solution to this equation. The point really is that if you're given a solution to this equation, and you're given the restriction of a solution to this equation to here, then you can extend it uniquely to here. Oops, runs right off the bottom. So this applies more generally to initial data for the wave equation in I'm not quite sure what I wrote there, but what I did want to say, in multiple times. So if you take, which is called an ultra-hyperbolic equation, so this equation looks like as a bunch of second derivatives, the sum of the second derivatives with respect to the spatial variables, the second derivatives of phi with respect to space is equal to the second derivative of phi with respect to time. That's the ordinary wave equation. If you throw another time variable in there, then you have what's called an ultra-hyperbolic equation. And what's interesting about ultra-hyperbolic equations for our purposes is that this sort of initial data surface is generic. I mean, it's the rule. So if you have two space and you have two time dimensions, or if you have three space and two time dimensions, then so let's say you have space, three space and two time, okay? An initial data surface of codimension one, which is almost certainly what you need in order to have a well-defined initial value problem, never mind well-posed. You want to give initial data on some surface. It's going to be a surface of four dimensions in this five-dimensional space, one dimension less, and one of the dimensions is going to be a time dimension. So you'll have an initial data surface which is extended in both space and time, which we call time-like, and you get a surface like this, and it has this funny property that this data is not freely specifiable. Okay, so again, you get a kind of non-local dependence. You have an ordinary sort of deterministic theory at work, and you can't use these, let me just sort of illustrate this non-local dependence a little better. Data in the red region is dictated in the blue region. So this is my R. This is just a slice of that surface, a little piece, okay? This is that same region R. If I know the data in here, then I know the data in this entire region, okay? It's almost a kind of, you could think about it as a kind of holography if you wanted to. It's kind of interesting to think about that. Incidentally, what this means is, given that 2 plus 1 space-time, if you have data running right along the time axis in some infinitely small region, so you can sort of just shrink this as much as you want, okay, and then rotate it around so you have some little finite, little tiny tube running up the time axis, that determines the solution everywhere in the entire space-time, assuming you don't cut the tube off. Okay, it's a very strange kind of initial value. Well, it's not really an initial value problem, but it's a strange sort of a dependence, but in a purely relativistic, ordinary theory, just viewed in a different from a different perspective. Now, I wanted to say one more thing about this. Yes, which is that as in the kind of theory we were thinking about before, there's no sense in which, you know, you might look at this and you think, well, why doesn't this mean that if I do something here, I make a change here, I can affect what's going on over here, okay? So we're going to try to adopt causal talk again to a situation in which we don't have free, we can't freely vary the initial conditions. But what I would argue is that the reason that you can't, you wouldn't say that and you can't say that is because you can't ponder what the effects of a given action here are. You can't, because if you change, if you do something different here, then that's going to be associated with an entirely different set of data all along here in the past and the future of that action and so on. On the other hand, what I would say is that if you have some other sort of analysis of causation which doesn't rely on this free specifiability, it just has something that's much more closely related to an event. Is it one event is a partial cause of another if it's part of a set of events which determine that other event, then you might want to test out your intuitions against this example, which is, after all, this is just a redescription of the physics of our world, all right, and ask, do I really want to say, or does my definition have as a consequence that I'm now saying that things here are causes of things here, Now, they could, depending on how you want to think about what cause means and what sorts of conditions it's supposed to mean. But I think it's a very interesting example to ponder, both in the context that we were exploring, in the context of a general analysis of causation in the physical world. So let me just summarize. I have no idea when I was supposed to stop or start, but what?
1 minute.
1 minute? Oh, that's beautiful, beautiful. Then I have no discussion, right? The effect of dropping the assumption of statistical independence depends on how it's dropped. Hidden variable theories which display weak dependence can't reproduce quantum mechanical predictions. Weak dependence is worse than independence in this respect. Theories with strong dependence may be able to reproduce quantum mechanics. I mean, I haven't given you one, but that seems open. Such theories obey strong locality in the Bell sense, and they do not allow superluminal signaling. But they insist on perennial, what I'm maybe contentiously calling perennial correlations between spatially separated degrees of freedom. Now, it's somewhat contentious because if you pick out two different degrees of freedom, say two particles, among a whole other set, there's no necessary sense in which these two separated from everything else are going to be correlated. But the fact is that there are constraints on the entire set of data at a given time. Thus, such correlations are not dynamically generated. So in a theory with strong dependence, it's not that correlations emerge, it's that they're always there. They're part of, it's very sort of consistent with a view of the quantum world which regards it as unitarily evolving. Let me leave it at that. Retrocausation is arguably a misnomer, but this is what I've sort of briefly suggested anyway. I don't know if I've actually succeeded in arguing. But non-causal correlations of this general sort are shown to be predictions of models with closed time-like curves and models with extra time dimensions. And I think that, though I don't think that either of those are directly applicable to quantum mechanics, so I don't think that you can explain quantum correlations by proposing the correct compact topology for space-time. I don't think the correlations are of the right sort. I do think that these examples are really worth thinking about in order to stretch the mind as to how one can reconcile, quantum mechanics, in particular the strange non-local correlations with relativity theory. Let me stop there.
Right.
No, but it's that way. I don't think I stated that clearly enough. I know what you mean. The idea is that something that's weak. Let me think how to put this.
Was it because in the particular weak dependence model you consider, some of the predictions of quantum mechanics could not reproduce, but those predictions maybe could be reproduced on a model which did not have weak dependence. But of course, a model which does not have weak dependence cannot probably develop a model. So maybe some models which have weak dependence may produce some things in quantum mechanics, but not all, and some which have independence can produce.
Right.
Okay.
Well,
I mean,
what I thought you were going to do in that part was to
right.
show that, assuming weak dependence, you could rewrite Bell the CHSH inequality. But you can't do that.
You can't do it straightforwardly. I think you can do it by just sort of, I was thinking about this just yesterday about how to do this. It's surprising. I mean, I think you have to do it sort of in a kind of, you have to sort of parcel out the states which are sensitive to, let's see how to put this. I think you can, but I don't think you can. I don't think it's a straightforward plug and chug. You can use the Bell, that sort of derivation, for the portion of the states which don't exhibit any interesting detector setting dependence, and then treat the detector, and then show that the detector setting dependence, the extent to which you have sensitivity of the state to detector settings, only takes you further away from the bound. It gets you further. I think it's going to confine you to somewhere less than. Well, you're already less than or equal to two,
yeah.
But you're going to put an upper bound. In other words, if you quantify the amount, the way in which you depend on the detector settings, your upper bound to the inequality is going to be even further away from, what is it, 2 root 2, that,
right,
that quantum mechanics gives you, yeah.
Right. But all you need is to rewrite the 2 root 2, you don't even have to get a time
bound for it. No, you don't. But I think the intuition here anyway, and I understand what you're getting at, and I haven't spelled it out completely clearly, is that if you have a sense, if the lambda is sensitive to detector settings individually and not jointly, and you have free control over, if you think of yourself as having free control over detector settings, the detector settings, and in any case are uncorrelated, then you're reducing the ability of what lambda is usually doing the normal story is lambda is the source of the correlations,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So now you're killing that off.
Yeah. Well, that's why I thought it should actually be easy to just prove that you can rewrite Bell.
Yeah, but if you just plug that relation in
to
I couldn't get it to work, because you have to get those things don't cancel very easily, and there are certain, I can show you, but I hear exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if we have any more time. Guido, is there more question?
I'd be interested in hearing Hugh's question. What about?
Oh, sure.
I've got a couple of minor points, and then I wanted to say something about the issue about
Okay, good.
The minor points, I mean, a sort of historical point. I think it's pretty clearly strong dependence that the first people who thought about these local causal approaches to the PPR and so on had in mind. I mean, Costa de Beauregard talking about zigzag causality. I mean, if you have that metaphor, then it's pretty clear that the measurement setting on one side is affecting not just the particle on that side, but it's supposed to be affecting the particle on the other side too. I mean, that's the zag, that's the zigzag.
Yeah.
I think it's very helpful to distinguish these two, but if there's anything in these sort of retrocausal ideas, it's going to be the strong one, which is interesting. The second thing was that, because I like the idea of sort of turning the diagram upside down as a way of trying to make it less counterintuitive. But I think that there's a little bit of a danger in doing that, which it may be that you were falling into a little bit, which is that by turning the diagram upside down, our intuitions kind of forget about the ordinary kind of dependence, which is the dependence, the ordinary kind of correlation, which is the correlation we expect between the two particles as a result of the fact that, as we ordinarily put it, they come out of the same source.
Mm-hmm.
And when we turn the diagram upside down, we just stop and go in the same place. And so we tend to forget about that kind of correlation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you put that one back in too, then again, it makes strong dependence look more natural than weak dependence.
Okay. Yeah, but I think that that's, I really don't, I think that's a bad way to look at it. it's a kind of a pseudo-dynamical explanation of the emergence of correlations in which the dynamics is going, seems to go this way and then this way. You know, it's the kind of thing that Kramer is always apologizing for.
Yeah, no, look, I think I agree
okay.
with that.
Right.
And the Einstein have reservations about
okay.
No one said, well, the important thing is the sort of holistic thing, just the map
yeah.
of correlations.
Right.
And then the tendency to think of things either causally or dynamically in some sense comes from us.
Right.
We, you know, the sort of laws give us the restrictions on the patterns, and then we start thinking about what we can do if we can wiggle something at one point. But anyway, that brings me to the main thing I wanted to say. I mean, I think the sort of worry you are having about counterfactuals and causation is something that it sort of bothered me too. And I'm inclined to think that what's going on is something like this. In the ordinary sort of folk case, we're not worrying even about relativity. There are sort of two ways to think about what's going on when we reason counterfactually in the way you describe, we think about, we hold various things fixed and then think about making a small change. And there are two ways of thinking about what we hold fixed, which in the ordinary case, pretty much go together. One is that we're just holding fixed the stuff that's in the past. The other is that we're just holding fixed the stuff that in principle we can know about at the time that we decide kind of what's real or how to weave it. In the classical picture,
okay.
we pretty much take for granted that those two things come to the same thing. Now, what's happening in these cases is those two things are coming apart. And when they come apart, we have a choice about how we want to do our counterfactual thinking. We could do it still holding fixed everything in the past, and that was, in a sense, what you were being attracted to. Or we could do it with what we think of holding fixed is the kind of stuff we could know about at the time when we decide on the choice of measurements. And if you do it that way, I think it then becomes much more natural to think that you have counterfactual control over lambda. Because lambda is precisely something that you can't know.
Yeah, this is Ken's point, I suppose, right? As long as you recognize that
there's that sort of choice of two things you could mean by counterfactual talk in those circumstances, then there's really no problem, because once they're both on the table, and you can be explicit about which one you're using, then sure, you'll say different things depending on which one you
yeah,
choose.
Yeah, right.
That's just a kind of semantic distinction at that point. That depends on it.
Right, but are you going to then? Are you
causation
then?
Too. You could say, look, there's sort of two versions of causation. I mean, in one sense, you do have a causal influence, and the other you don't. But again, it's just a terminological difference.
Right. But so, are you going to say then that you're a cause here? That I'm not quite sure how it's going to come out under your.
Yeah, no, I'm not clear about how it's going to work in this case.
Right.
I'm thinking more about it.
Okay. Good. Well.
Okay.
Thank you.
I was looking at the other one.